It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a new investigative report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looks at possible contamination from companies that recycle steel chemical barrels. We'll talk to one of the reporters behind that investigation.
First, we're looking back at President Trump's first month in office. Here he is during his press conference last Thursday.
This last month has represented an unprecedented degree of action on behalf of the great citizens of our country. Again, I say it, there has never been a presidency that's done so much in such a short period of time. And we haven't even started the big work yet.
A press release put out today by the Office of the Press Secretary of the White House listed actions the president has taken so far in office, grouped into categories like a job creation, saving taxpayer money, restoring public safety, getting government out of the way, and other categories.
Paul Nolet joins us now to talk about President Trump's first month in office. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Well, as we just heard there, President Trump said there has never been a presidency that has done so much in such a short period of time. Does the American public agree with that?
Well, I think overall, the American public does see Trump as quite active and kind of willing to take a stand on a bunch of different stuff. But overall, he and his actions haven't been terribly popular overall as a general matter.
Well, as a laundry list, what can we put there under accomplished in that first month?
Well, it's interesting because in terms of Trump's accomplishments over the last month, what's interesting about it is that a lot of them have been focused on executive actions and executive orders. I believe through today, he's only signed three bills into law, none of which are particularly important bills. Most of the important stuff he's done so far have been executive actions. But, you know, even there, his most prominent one dealing with immigration is now tied up in the courts. So it's been, I'd say it's fair to say it's been a fairly rocky start over the first month.
Well, there have been people who say that is a rocky start, like you, maybe more chaotic. Others who say that leaning in the other direction you were talking about, this is a president who's been very active, who has indicated that he is looking to make good on campaign promises. Overall, what do you think the perception is?
Yeah, I think the perception is that Trump is willing to take action. And in fact, in polls that look and ask, hey, do you think Trump is a decisive actor? The majority of people say yes. But then if they ask, do you approve of how he's doing in office, those numbers are quite a bit lower. So I think overall, it's not terribly surprising that you have somebody coming in who never held a governmental position before but wants to take very quick, very decisive action. It's almost inevitable that there's going to be some rocky patches as Trump navigates a new type of institution that he really hasn't run before.
We're talking with Paul Nolet right now, talking about President Trump's first month in office. Paul Nolet is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. And let's talk about the president's cabinet. Does he have the players in place that he needs to advance his agenda, considering that President Trump has had a very active business career but has not been a political player?
Right, and that's one area where I think he has fallen a bit behind the timetable that I think incoming presidents want to have at this point. He does have some key cabinet members in place, but there's still a few to go, and there's also hundreds of other Senate appointees that have to be confirmed by the Senate that remain to be filled, number of positions. And so until they're filled, I think it's going to be difficult for Trump to fully carry out his agenda. So we'll see if he's able to pick up the pace a bit in the coming weeks and months. But I think as it stands right now, that's going to be a barrier for some decisive action.
Here's the president on that topic at a press conference last Thursday.
I turn on the TV, open the newspapers, and I see stories of chaos. Yet it is the exact opposite. This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine, despite the fact that I can't get my cabinet approved.
A couple things going on in that a little bit there. We talked about the cabinet a bit, and also he's saying he sees stories of chaos. He does not agree with those stories, and this gets at this ongoing friction he's had with the media. He's been upset with the coverage there. How do you think that aspect has been affecting his presidency thus far?
Yeah, I think it has bothered him for sure. I mean, he spent a lot of his time both on Twitter and in speeches talking about the media and really criticizing a variety of media actors. And it indicates to me that he is quite concerned about the coverage that he's getting. And so he wants to try to present a different story about what's going on in the administration. But I think it's important there for the administration to really show, not tell. I mean, it's one thing to say that you're a well-oiled machine and everything's going great, but if for everybody on the outside of the White House, including the media, is seeing a different picture, I think he has to address that gap.
It seems as though the president is, as far as we can tell, a big media consumer, and he does have this perspective that's unique. He has had extensive experience as not in the media per se, but on television. Do you think that is going to inform the dynamic we're seeing between the president and the media going forward?
Yeah, and I think all throughout the campaign, the whole year and a half or so prior to him being elected president, I think he demonstrated that he really is a skillful media user, and he's continued that as president, and I expect him to continue that moving forward. And I mean, one thing that he has as an advantage so far is that even though his approval ratings are really historically low for an incoming president, his base is still very much with him. And I think especially through tweets and through some of his rallies, for instance, that he continues to have even as president, he's really speaking to his base. And so even though his approval ratings may be going down, he at least still has a pretty solid chunk of the American populace that are behind him. And I think his media strategy is very much geared to maintaining that base.
Well, let's talk about the polls a little bit as we go. Trump referenced recently a Rasmussen poll that showed his administration had a 55% approval rating. That might be an outlier. Where do you see him in the aggregate of the polling?
Yeah, most of the polls, I think actually all of them are lower than that one. That one had the highest approval rating indicated. And they've ranged everywhere from about 39%. I know a Pew poll recently indicated that, and then a bunch in the 40s as well. And I think the big picture here is that this is much, much lower approval rating than typical for an incoming president. I mean, even President Obama, who did eventually, during periods of his presidency, dip to close to 40%, he started with almost 80% approval, and it was a very gradual slide downwards. But with President Trump, it started at a very low mid-40s or so number, and if anything, has actually gone down over the last few weeks.
I want to touch on the question of temperament right now. Are there lingering questions there? He had this bombastic personal style that a lot of people, well, his supporters, I should say, saw as an asset. It did win him the presidency over a huge field of other Republican contenders. Now he's installed in the office of the president. So is that style working for President Trump or against him?
I think it's mostly working against him at this point. And he's already been quite frustrated with, for instance, what I would call his signature move so far, which is the immigration executive orders. I mean, now they're tied up in courts, and it's going to be quite a while before they can get implemented, even if they ever do. And so I think Trump is coming into a situation working in government for the first time where it's a much different institution, and he's just not used to that. And there's a lot of growing pains that he's encountering. So one indication that he's undergoing some frustration here is that, as I mentioned before, he's now holding rallies, almost like campaign rallies, as president right at the beginning of his term, which is very unusual that he'd be doing that. And I think that's the style he's comfortable with. He's not as comfortable with the governing style that has worked for presidents in the past.
And Paul, just briefly before we let you go, what are you going to be watching for in the coming months to see how this presidency is working and headed?
I'm going to see how much he works with Congress on legislation, which has been pretty slow going so far, and also whether he builds on some of the executive orders that he's already put out there, including on immigration. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Paul Nolet, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He was with us to talk about Donald Trump's first month in office.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, a guest tries to get to the bottom of why we as humans underprepare for disasters and what we can do about it.
Right now, the steel and plastic drums that house various chemicals may not be at the forefront of most people's minds. But a new investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found that these barrels can pose a danger.
In a news series, the Journal Sentinel looked at the industry that recycles those barrels and the chemical hazards they present for workers, the environment, and surrounding communities.
Raquel Rutledge joins us now. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She co-wrote the series titled Burned. Raquel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
So this is an industry I think most people probably haven't thought of. There's these barrels that hold all kinds of different chemicals, 55-gallon drums a lot of the time. And then there's this industry that refurbishes them so they can be used again. What kind of chemicals are in these barrels?
Well, everything you can imagine, everything known to man. There's tens of thousands of chemical compounds that come through, and that ported across the country in these drums, and the recycling and refurbishing industry is booming these days. 27 million barrels are reconditioned every single year, and so that presents a hazard to the people that are actually doing the work and then those in the surrounding neighborhoods.
And this is an industry around the country and in the Milwaukee area. Can you talk about the kinds of businesses there are there?
Sure. Well, there's three that are around that are in the Milwaukee area, one in St. Francis, one in Oak Creek, and another one right in Milwaukee near 24th and Hampton. And what they do is they take in these chemical totes, and what happens is the companies that are shipping these containers to be recycled will sometimes leave chemical waste sloshing in the bottom. They're supposed to send barrels that are empty to be cleaned and refurbished, but they end up sending stuff that has remains in the bottom, and often they're not labeled. So the workers that are taking these things off the trucks on the docks don't know what kind of chemicals they're dealing with, and often they're hazardous. And what they do is they pour them off into a single container. So they'll drain off something from one barrel into another, and not knowing what they're mixing, and so they're creating all these chemical reactions that create toxic fumes, and in some cases have the drums explode, and they killed one worker a long time ago in Milwaukee, but they've had a lot of near misses since then. And in addition, the workers get chemical burns that are just horrendous. I mean, these things, the chemicals will eat through their skin, and it's just a very dangerous environment.
So if I'm working at a place like this, one of these, I think they call them heavies, shows up. It's heavier than it should because it has liquid chemicals in it that it shouldn't. It shows up. I don't know. I may or may not know what it is. I dump it into another barrel that has other chemicals. I may not know what they are. I mean, I took chemistry back in high school. This sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Exactly, exactly. And what's really interesting about this is that we had a whistleblower come forward, a person who works in the safety risk management industry, and he was in these plants around Milwaukee and also in Indianapolis, Memphis, and in Arkansas, and he was working with one of the company's safety managers, and talking about understanding the different things that are going on there. And the safety manager of the company was worried. He said, hey, these things could blow up and kill eight people in a heartbeat. I mean, the company's safety manager knew the risks of what was going on in these plants and was trying to get some things sorted out and trying to get improvements made, but the executives weren't really paying much attention to him. So then we had, so the safety consultant blew the whistle and came to us with 16 hours of audio recordings that he had, he had secretly recorded while he was in these plants talking to the workers and talking to the managers, et cetera.
And when these barrels show up with stuff in them, as I understand it from your reporting, if I'm at that company, I'm supposed to say, no, take it back. I'm not supposed to even accept this.
That's right. And the workers that we interviewed said that doesn't happen. I mean, on occasion it might happen, but by practice they take them because you know, they're some of their biggest customers that are sending this stuff, and they don't want to lose those contracts. And so often, most of the time they will just typically, you know, process them, take them, and deal with it.
And then what do they do with the chemicals? This stew of chemicals in a barrel, where do they go?
Yeah, well, so they get sent out. They get drummed up. So that's they put a cap on those drums, and those are the ones sometimes that explode and have reactions. But then they send them out. They get picked up and hauled off and sent out as non-hazardous waste to landfills.
And in some cases, these are chemicals that would be categorized as hazardous waste?
In some cases, yes.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, she co-wrote a series titled Burned on the industry, this is in Milwaukee area and elsewhere, that refurbishes big 55-gallon steel drums that carries chemicals and what happens to the chemicals, the workers, and the communities. And Raquel, you've written about also written about neighborhoods, talking about what they're seeing and smelling from these facilities. What did you find?
Yeah, well, they have experienced, I don't think they're necessarily the neighborhood, the people in the neighborhoods aren't necessarily aware of what's going on, but they have known, they have complained over the years about odors and things coming from these plants. And the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District has records showing that they've exceeded their limits for emissions of mercury and for volatile organic compounds, et cetera. But a lot of times I think what happens is people don't know. I mean, there was one case when they mixed something together in one of the drums and it just created this horrendous black cloud that was blown out into the neighborhood for 20 minutes. One of the safety managers was describing what happened, and the workers say they have to clear out of the building and stay outside for at least 30 minutes. And they said the other thing they do sometimes is put the drums outside of the plant to just evaporate into the air. They call them stinkers. And when they put those stinkers out, uncap them, and let them evaporate into the air, which can be problematic as well.
And you also wrote that in some cases, these companies, if they know they're doing something that will involve a lot of black smoke, they'll make sure they do it before sunup.
That's what one of the workers in Arkansas said they did early, before dawn, process the awful stuff. And there, we had some documentation as well that workers were telling one of the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspector that came to one of the plants in Arkansas. They interviewed some workers there, and they were telling him that, when you guys come in, we have a whole set of clean drums that we are ready to process, and we have another trailer where we hide the dirty stuff that we know we're not supposed to be doing. The supervisors have told them to do that. So that was documented in some of the OSHA reports as well.
Have there been fines or other regulatory actions against businesses in the Milwaukee area or others?
Not huge. I mean, MMSD said they told me, hey, we're not in the business of fining these companies. We're trying to get them to comply. So, and they're nominal for the most part. The plant in Indianapolis was OSHA did propose a $300,000 fine, which was fairly significant, but they negotiated down to $100,000, and that was, for many, many violations. But so, no, typically not. Typically, they're very small. They get issued warnings after warning after warning, but not a lot of teeth in those warnings.
What did you hear from people in the industry?
From people in the industry? I mean,
in the refurbishing industry, yeah. I mean, the management and ownership.
They say that's not what they do. They said they have a policy of not doing that, and that they did acknowledge that they had some problems in these plants. I mean, they couldn't deny it. We had 16 hours of their own safety manager outlining everything that they were doing wrong. So they had a hard time kind of denying it, but what they did say is, hey, that was, back in, late last year, they fixed this stuff up. And so they've made some improvements, and they're looking at automating some of the processes to protect the workers. And they deny pouring, some of the chemical wash down the floor drain. They deny a bunch of the stuff and say they fixed the other stuff that was a problem.
Yeah, you mentioned the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. Are these chemicals in some cases, from what you've heard from people who've worked at these places, just dumped down the drain?
Yeah, one of the Milwaukee plants, we heard it from worker after worker who said that's what they do. Now, they weren't just dumping the chemicals directly from the drums down the drain, but they would pour them off into the collection drum, and then when they were washing the totes and they would use caustic stuff to wash, sometimes just water, but whatever residue was left in those drums, that was being washed down the drain. So that was from the safety manager said that, as well as other workers that worked there.
Since you've put out this report, have you heard anything from people in the Milwaukee area with the city or otherwise looking to investigate, crack down if need be?
Yeah, and I mean, the city has, I guess, been out there twice since we started inquiring. So we started asking the company about what was going on back in December. We gave them plenty of notice that we were looking into this and gave them plenty of opportunity to respond and tell us and show us, hey, what do you actually do in there? We wanted to be extremely fair and get, you know, to get to the bottom of the truth of what was going on. But so since then, yes, I guess the city has been out a couple of times, hasn't found an immediate danger. So I'm suspecting that they have straightened up some of the stuff that they're doing, but I don't know that they've, you know, certainly been able to address all the issues, because kind of their practices are inherently unsafe the way they've been doing things.
You've heard from workers at these plants. You've seen, as you mentioned, OSHA reports. Are the people working there worried about their health and well-being?
Very much so. I mean, when you look, I don't know if you saw some of the pictures, but when you see, you know, it's easy to think, oh, you know, a chemical burn, or, you know, imagine what a burn looks like. But when you see some of the photos of some of these injuries, I mean, they are horrendous. Those workers are terrified. And one of the workers I talked to in Arkansas said every time, every day before his shift and during his shift, he just prayed. He just, you know, prayed that nothing terrible would happen to him, because they, every day after day, they would see people get burned, because some of the places have furnaces where they burn off the chemicals with the steel drums, and they'd have flashback fires, and people had their faces burned. The chemical burns, one guy from his knee to his ankle, I mean, his whole leg, all the skin on his leg was just eaten away. I mean, these are serious injuries. People had been splashed in the eyes with hydrochloric acid. I mean, just nasty stuff.
We'll leave it there for now. Raquel, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
That's Raquel Rutledge, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the investigative piece she reported on called Burned. It looks at the industry surrounding refurbishing chemical barrels and the dangers the drums and their contents can pose.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the reasons why we underprepare for disasters and what, if anything, can be done to change that. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Today, commonly known as President's Day, especially if you're looking at ads for the new car, mattress, or refrigerator. The third Monday in February that we think of as President's Day was actually originally pegged to George Washington's birthday on February 22nd. Later, it was expanded to honor another president with a February birthday, Abraham Lincoln.
Brady Carlson joins us now for a look at the afterlives of presidents and what happens to their historical images after they pass away. Brady's a reporter and the host of All Things Considered on WPR. He's also the author of the book Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Brady, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you first get interested in not just the lives of presidents, but the afterlives of presidents?
Well, when I first started traveling to these sites, it was because that was as close as I could get to a Thomas Jefferson or an Abraham Lincoln. I thought this is as close as I could get to meeting the living presidents. But the more time I spent at the grave sites and at the monuments and the memorials, I realized there were stories about how each of these sites, each of these monuments came together. And those were really a story that were part of the present, that those stories continued into today, not only as part of their stories, but part of our stories, how we understand the people we've chosen to lead the country and how we look at the presidency as a job and as an institution in our politics and in our culture.
And it sounds like this became not just a Brady obsession, but a family thing for you. Your family came along. What did they think of this quest you were on?
They thought it was a bit morbid, which is understandable. But I think they got a kick out of seeing these often places that are hiding in plain sight. I mean, an obvious example is Abraham Lincoln's tomb in Springfield, Illinois, which is a really, really solemn place, understandably so, and a place that lots of people go visit. It's one of the most heavily visited cemeteries in America. But to learn about the attempt to steal Lincoln's body and hold it for ransom in the 1870s, and the efforts that people went to, often very secret lengths, to keep his body intact and to actually, it's under 12 feet of concrete today to keep it safe from potential future grave robbers. To find those kinds of stories, I think, made it more fun for all of us. It was a little odd for my now oldest son. He was my only kid at the time. He thought all presidents were dead. And so we would explain to him later on, he had a chance to see then President Obama in person. And he kept saying, he was president long ago. He died. We had to say, no, he's still alive. The other guys died.
Some chronology things that the kids were working out with the presidents.
Yeah, when you're two, I guess it's harder to understand the scope of history.
Well, you brought up Lincoln and going to see his memorial place, his resting place. And I read in your book about how you were surprised that some people were just, they weren't really affected by it. They were more there as tourists. And I had that same reaction. I went to the Lincoln Memorial in D.C., not his actual, you know, resting place, his grave. But it did seem to have the solemnity, but it was clear that not everybody felt it. I mean, how do people process it when they go to these sites?
It depends on the person, I think. There are people who are very emotionally invested in visiting the Lincoln Memorial. I mean, that's one of the truly iconic American statues in the Lincoln Memorial, and it's got some of his most eloquent words written on the sides of the building. You can stand in the spot where Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I have a dream." And you can also be surrounded by dozens and dozens of people who are taking selfies of themselves. So, I mean, people come to the presidential sites for a lot of different reasons. And some of them are historical and some of them are, quote unquote, respectful. And others are just for entertainment or fun or just to document that they had been to a well-known place. And I don't really have a problem with that, like I did when I was 10 and I was offended by the people who were not really taking the Abraham Lincoln tomb as seriously as I was. But it also shows that we have a lot of different reactions to the presidency as a job and the people who have held that job.
Well, as you wrote this book, which presidents stand out to you for how revered they were, maybe both at the time and shortly after their death and now?
I think the most interesting story to me, I really like stories about how our views of history change. And so I thought the story of how Thomas Jefferson has changed in the course of history was a fascinating story. Thomas Jefferson, of course, the author of the Declaration of Independence, he did the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, you can go on and on and on about Thomas Jefferson's intellectual and political successes. But over time, our understanding of him and his life have changed so much because of what we've learned about the institution of slavery, how that institution perpetuated itself at Thomas Jefferson's plantation, Monticello, and the evidence that he had a relationship and fathered children by one of the enslaved women at Monticello, Sally Hemings. That was something that was extremely controversial among historians for centuries. And it was only really in the last few decades that people started taking that idea seriously, that maybe there was more to the story of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings than the whispered rumors that had always been out there. And now you see the people who run Monticello are now restoring the room they believe Sally Hemings lived in, and they're showing that as an official piece of Thomas Jefferson and Monticello history. So her story is now coming back out there, not just his.
Interesting. Well, and you also say that if you want to start at the beginning, you start with Washington. This is not only the first president, but an incredibly revered president, maybe second only, and that's arguable, to Abraham Lincoln. And his afterlife, it was pretty interesting there. It sounds like he didn't want a big to-do. People mourned like crazy anyway. He wanted to be married at Mount Vernon. Congress said, no, you're going to be buried in Washington. And it was a process.
It was a huge process, and it was a very revealing process, because more or less everything that we see in the world of dead presidents starts with George Washington. Remember, the country started with this idea that we wanted to have a chief executive and not a king. And Washington thought of everything he did in that light. How can I best perpetuate this idea of a leader chosen by the people who represents the people and holds power for a very finite period of time before giving it to someone else, rather than establishing perpetual power in a single individual or a single job. And so he wanted to have a private funeral, a private burial, a private life outside of national politics. And people were so tied into George Washington as a national hero, the father of the country, our first president, that they really couldn't let him do that. George Washington was, by some accounts, so influential in the early days of the country that his force of personality was almost the only thing that kept North, South, the expanding parts of the country, people who very strongly disagreed on a lot of issues, kept them all working on this one single experiment. Let's all stick it out and be one country. And when he was gone, well, maybe that unity wasn't going to hold anymore because his force of personality wasn't there to keep everybody on the same page. So they essentially turned George Washington into something larger than life after he died. They created this mythical figure. This is the point where we have the biography come out with all these not real stories about George Washington chopping the cherry tree down and saying, "I cannot tell a lie." Stories, paintings about George Washington ascending into heaven as a sort of demigod. That's actually what you can see if you go to the U.S. Capitol building in Washington and you look up to the inside of the Capitol dome in the rotunda. You see, it's called the Apotheosis of Washington. So George Washington becomes this huge figure. And with that, there goes the idea of the president being a private figure who takes power for a short period of time and then returns to private life. Once you're a president, always a president. And that's sort of the long and the short of George Washington's political and mythical rise. And his physical death was a little more complicated. He had been buried on his plantation, Mount Vernon, in an old tomb that was right next to the Potomac River, and that was prone to flooding. He had asked that there be a new tomb built further inland so that his bones could rest and not be washed down the river. But the plantation was inefficient and unprofitable, and it took some 30 years before that was actually done. And in the meantime, somebody tried to break into the tomb and steal his bones, and there were lots of problems along those lines. So George Washington got what he wanted in a sense, but it took a long time.
We're talking with Brady Carlson right now. He's a reporter and the host of All Things Considered at WPR. And he's the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And speaking of strange deaths, let's talk about James Garfield, an untimely end there. Unfortunate, and there are many kind of like this, where you wonder, how did this happen? But tell us about James Garfield.
Well, James Garfield is almost completely forgotten today, and that's in large part because he was assassinated so early on in his term. At least that's the official story. Assassinated is probably overstating it. He certainly was shot twice by a deranged office seeker named Charles Guiteau in a Washington, D.C. train station. But what really did him in was neither of those bullets, but the incompetent medical care that he got from a man whose name was, and this is his name, not his title, Dr. Willard Bliss. He was named for the doctor who attended to his mother while he was being born. Dr. Bliss did not believe in germ theory, which was a relatively new thing, but had been widely accepted in Europe, not so much by American doctors. He and a number of the other doctors who attended to Garfield would check for where the bullets had gone by poking him with unsterilized fingers. Those unsterilized fingers introduced germs into the president's body. He spent the next few months before he died in great pain, agony. They fed him the foods that his stomach could not handle. They gave him whiskey that they thought would help. It didn't help. And so poor James Garfield was done in by his doctors. And interestingly enough, when Charles Guiteau, the assassin, went on trial for the murder of the president, he defended himself by saying, "The doctors are the ones who killed him. I just shot him." And that didn't go over well with the jury. He was eventually put to death. But it was confirmed later on in the autopsy and then by medical historians since that James Garfield was killed more by the medical care that was supposed to protect him from those bullets than the bullets themselves.
And Brady, just briefly as we wrap up, you ponder a question. What is the job of a dead president? Do you have an answer for that?
The job of a dead president is to help us understand how we look at ourselves and how we look at the president, who is the one person who we all elect, the one person who represents all of us. So the more we understand, the more we look at whether we build something as huge as Mount Rushmore, or we're carving giant faces of our leaders into the mountain, or just the ways that we put presidents' names on schools or streets, that tells us something about the importance that we place on this particular job and the unique place that it has in our lives.
Brady, thanks so much for talking.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Brady Carlson is a reporter and the host of All Things Considered on WPR. He joined us to talk about his book called Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, disaster can strike at any moment. We'll learn from an expert why people tend to under-prepare.
First, in an ongoing series, WPR News is reporting on a class of Madison police recruits as they go through the training academy.
They're entering the field at a time when police shootings across the nation and here in Wisconsin have drawn intense scrutiny from the public. As part of their training, each recruit is put through a mock shooting scenario, from pulling the trigger all the way through the investigation. Bridget Bowden has more.
One of the last blocks of training in the six-month-long academy teaches the recruits what to expect after a so-called officer-involved critical incident. These can include shootings, in-custody deaths, and serious car crashes that involve squad cars. The training starts with a scenario. The recruits get a pretend call that there's an unwanted person in a building. They believe that their partner has found the person and is okay. Here's training officer Chris Masterson.
As the door opens, they see our suspect swinging a shovel down at an officer on the ground, and there's fake blood on the ground. And the way it looks like the subject's striking our officer in the head.
Every recruit draws their gun and fires multiple rounds.
Some of them had genuine, like they felt guilty, like their partner was got hit because it took them too long to draw their gun out, or their decision-making directly affected their partner, which is good. It means they took the scenario real, but also shows like how emotional these things can be. Like, they know it's fake.
The next day, they're interviewed by an MPD detective and an agent from the Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation. Since 2014, state law has required all officer-involved shootings to be investigated by an independent agency like DCI. Before recruit Mark Golden joined the MPD, he was a UW-Madison officer. In 2010, he was involved in a critical incident where a drunk driver crashed and died during a car chase. He says the exercise is a pretty accurate simulation of what actually happens after a critical incident.
Obviously, there's a lot more emotions involved when you're going through the real thing, but sitting down with detectives and being interviewed about what you ate for breakfast and your workout routine, you know, 8 hours prior to your shift, what did you do, you know, every single detail.
He says going through the simulation brought back lots of emotions.
I don't know if it can ever prepare you for when something like that happens, but it definitely exposes people to the possibility or what is, you know, the next step.
Lieutenant Marianne Flynn Stotz oversees the training academy. She says this block of training is separate from the use of force training, where they learn how to decide whether or not to pull the trigger. This is about what happens after that decision is already made.
It's likely the most isolating and life-impacting event that they're ever going to encounter. And as trainers, we have a responsibility to prepare them for that worst day of their life when they've had to make a deadly force decision.
In 2014, Sergeant Dave McClurg and another officer shot and killed a man who charged them with a knife after stabbing several other people. As a part of the training, he spoke to the recruits, sharing exactly what was going through his head before, during, and after the shooting. He says he reacted exactly as he was trained.
So our training is who we are, and it's the way we, you know, the way we do business. And if there's critiques to be made, which maybe there are, you know, there's certainly always room for improvement. I think the thing to look at is the training.
He says his advice to the recruits is to take their training seriously.
There are so many things that people get put through in training that potentially you could be involved in. And I think that, you know, we have a violent world where if you can do that and do some preparation.
And he says he hopes they will never actually encounter a situation where they have to use what they've learned. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For the rest of our Police Academy series, visit WPR.org/Police Academy.
WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden joins us now in the studio for more. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
talk about how some of these recruits were affected by going through that situation. As you said in the piece, they knew this wasn't a real thing, but it was still obviously very powerful.
Sure. So they didn't actually know what to expect. Mm-hmm. They knew that they were going to be going through some sort of scenario, but they didn't know it was going to be one in which they had to draw their gun and shoot someone. So it was very emotional. I think a lot of them were kind of shaken at the fact that they saw a pretend, officer on the ground with a pool of blood next to his head. I think that that was really dramatic. And some of them said that they felt guilty, that they didn't make it there in time, even though it was all set up so that couldn't have been avoided. But they were shaken.
And part of this is for the officer to deal with that trauma should this kind of thing happen in real life. What are the next steps after they go through this stimulated encounter?
So immediately after they shoot, the scenario is sort of paused and they are taken into the next room where they give a public safety statement, which is something that happens should this happen in real life. It's basically a statement where the officer involved tells the officer who shows up what's going on. Here's what the scene looks like. Here are the witnesses, basically anything that they need to take over that scene. So they gave the public safety statement immediately. And then the next day they were interviewed by a detective from the NPD and then an agent from DCI. And that simulated the formal interview that would take place during an investigation into one of these incidents.
And that's part of the process relatively new in Wisconsin that requires an outside investigation of any police-involved shooting or fatality.
Yes, so that law was signed by Governor Walker in 2014. And so any officer-involved shooting has to be investigated by an independent agency, in many cases, DCI.
And in your story, you talk about more than just officer-involved shootings. There are other scenarios in which critical incidents can occur, a death in a police chase, things like that. What are some of the different scenarios that, even if they don't simulate them, they talk about in this situation?
So according to the Madison Police Department's policy, an officer-involved critical incident can involve anything where an officer causes a death or an injury that is likely to cause death. So that can, of course, be a shooting. It can also be a death in custody. It can also be a serious car crash involving a squad car where someone dies. So all of that is encompassed under one policy.
And in this training, what kind of questions do officers get asked in the process afterward and in that, as you said, the day after simulated investigation?
So everything. The investigators are going to ask, what did you have for breakfast this morning? What's your workout routine like? How much sleep did you get last night? Anything that could be relevant to what happened on the day.
And is there, I don't know if the training got into this, but I mean, this is traumatic for all involved in a situation like this. Was there talk about the psychological well-being of the officer after these kind of incidents?
Yes, there absolutely was. The recruits' families were actually invited in one night to basically have dinner together and then talk to a support group of officer families just to talk about what this kind of thing looks like, talk about the support networks that are available. So both the officers, the recruits, and their families talked about the emotional impacts.
And you talked to officers who went through non-simulated situations, actual places where they used lethal force, including Sergeant Dave McClurg, who had shot and killed a man who charged at them with a knife after stabbing other people. What did he say about that experience?
Right. So there were actually two officers who spoke to the recruit class about critical incidents that they were involved in, and Sergeant McClurg was one of them. So he basically took them through the whole situation, told them what happened before, how he got to the call, what happened at the call, what was going through his head at the time, and sort of how it's been after, what the aftermath of the shooting has been like for him.
And Bridget, briefly as we wrap up, do you get the gist that this is something that Madison does uniquely, or is this a common kind of training for other police departments?
So it's definitely common for police departments to train on how to make the decision. This is sort of separate than that. They've spent a lot of time in the recruit class learning what is justified and what is not. This is sort of taking it a step further and is talking about what happens after you have made that decision, if you do make that decision.
Bridget, once again, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden. She joined us to talk about her story on how police recruits are learning to deal with officer-involved shootings and other critical incidents. It's part of an ongoing series following a class of Madison police recruits.
A Wisconsin music legend passed away this weekend. Clyde Stubblefield, the original funky drummer, died at the age of 73 in Madison.
Clyde was widely acknowledged as one of the most influential drummers in music history and the most sampled drummer ever, especially for his tracks playing with the James Brown Band. And, of course, he's well known to WPR listeners for his years of work on What Do You Know?
Clyde joined us on Central Time a little over a year ago. He was being honored at a benefit concert that raised money for music school programs.
It's an honor because I like to work with kids and give kids the chance to do something. It makes a big difference in my life.
And he gave us some behind-the-scenes insight on how a James Brown song came together.
When we're in a studio, we start setting up, and once we get set up, we start grooving on stuff. And Brown will walk in, has no idea, and go, hey, what's that y'all playing? Just keep it going. I put some lyrics to it, and it'll become a hit.
We'll spend more time talking about Clyde's career and his music later this week. For now, we'll go out with just the drums. Here's Clyde along with James Brown bandmate Jabbo Starks. This is Central Time.